Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Today says Americans are conflicted about digital privacy. We post and chat and share, we shop and register and bank online, but at the same time, we're anxious about the loss of control over our personal information. And that anxiety, she writes, has spawned a consumer privacy industry, which over the past two decades has changed, presenting different priorities to customers. We're talking today with Nora Draper. She's an assistant professor of communication at UNH and author of the new book, The Identity Trade: Selling Privacy and Reputation Online. It's a study of the companies that have promised privacy over the years and the role they've played in how the rest of us feel about the meaning of privacy in our lives. Let's hear from you this hour. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Nora Draper, it's nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what does the word privacy mean in the digital space today?
Well, so when we think about what the word privacy means, I think a lot of the time we think about secrecy or invisibility. But in fact, really what privacy is our efforts to achieve desirable levels of visibility. And so when we put the word digital or online in front of something, it's really easy, I think, to feel like it's entirely new. But really what we're talking about when we talk about digital privacy are the ways in which we translate those desires that we have to be seen in some contexts and not seen in other contexts, to kind of manage the ways that people have access to us and to information about us in a digital context.
And describe how wide the digital context is today, Nora, because what's so interesting about this book is you kind of go back 20 years and just talk about how every year our digital presence gets a little bit larger.
Yeah. So when we think about the introduction of new communication or new media technologies, I think one of the things that often accompanies those, whether it's the mail system or the telephone or, you know, the telegraph or the internet, is that those boundaries for how we have kind of managed our visibility in the past get disrupted. And so we have these kind of strategies that we can think about for controlling or managing the ways that people see us. And when we get a new media that kind of changes the way that information is collected, circulated, accessed, shared, some of those strategies are no longer as effective as they used to be. So when we think about digital communication or digital technologies, you know, when we engage with any sort of digital entity, whether that's, you know, clicks on a website or downloads of an app or, you know, even going through an EasyPass terminal, that information we're leaving sort of what we sometimes refer to as data trails or data exhaust. And when those are sort of collected, we're told that they start to paint a picture of us. And so when we talk about digital privacy, oftentimes what we're talking about are the ways in which those images are being created, those sort of reputations are being created about who we are in ways that we may or may not be familiar with or even able to see.
Well, and we are, those pieces of information describe part of us, but they don't describe all of us. I think that's the thing that's so frustrating for people.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, increasingly, I think we are being told that there is something sort of objective or true about those data trails, that when you think about the websites you visit or the things you buy online or the stories that you share, that there is, that that's revealing some sort of kind of objective truth about what we might be interested in or who we might be as a person, you know, when no one else is watching. But in fact, there really isn't a whole lot that is objective about that. Those data are being interpreted, and our perceptions and preferences are interpreted alongside that.
Again, our number here in the Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What are your major concerns when it comes to online privacy? What do you no longer worry about, either because you don't think it's important or you just feel there's nothing you can really do? Again, we'd love to hear from you. Exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Nora, about 20 years ago, you write, there was a lot of talk about the so-called death of privacy. What was the idea that people were playing with back then, and is it still relevant?
Sure. So, this idea of the death of privacy is one that's come up, throughout history.
Oh, really? So, not just in the last, 20, 30 years?
No. So we can even think, in the 20th century, with the rise of computer databases, and about the 1960s, the government was starting to digitize a lot of citizen information. And there was a lot of concern about the idea of a sort of centralized government database where information from a whole bunch of different government departments might be sort of collected and centralized. And so in the 60s and the early 70s, we got this idea of, well, what's going to happen to our privacy if all of this information is kind of collected in one place? So in the 1990s, I think we see a lot of similar concerns as people are starting to get access to the internet via the World Wide Web. They have access to broadband in their homes or at work. We see people starting to go online to do things like search for information or shop or plan their vacations. And I think you start to get this kind of sense arising in the general population that there are ways in which that information could be viewed by other people, and that people are starting to sort of have some anxieties about what the consequences of that might be.
In the book you mentioned this, I think it was a big Time magazine cover spread,
yeah.
And, the death of privacy and so forth. And even though that was more than 20 years ago,
yeah.
Some of the concerns that the author presents way back when people weren't online nearly as much as they are now, was way before the smartphone was invented and so forth. Some of the concerns he expresses are concerns that people still have today.
Absolutely. And I think, when we think about some of the ways in which people were talking about privacy concerns at the time, it was maybe a little less specific than they are today. I think today people are really concerned about, specific companies or specific types of information. And so it might have been a kind of vaguer concern in the 1990s as people were really starting to learn, what digital technologies were and what types of information they might be, able to glean, but certainly a lot of those concerns were very similar to the ones we see today.
So today, Nora, how much privacy can we really expect online? What's reasonable and what isn't?
Well, I think when we think about privacy and we think about what's reasonable, I mean, this whole idea of the death of privacy is I think comes out of this notion that we can't accept privacy or can't expect privacy. There is no privacy anymore. But so long as people, I think, are still kind of concerned about this idea of privacy, are still kind of taking steps to manage their privacy, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to talk about the fact that privacy is dead. If we kind of look throughout history, this is something that's happened time and time again. So I think it's better to think about, rather than the death of privacy, maybe the renegotiation of privacy. What does it really mean for us to think about this idea in a digital world where a lot of our information is collected and shared, and a lot of the ways that we kind of are managing that have to be a little bit different?
Well, how much do the expectations change, do you think, Nora, depending on what you're doing online? If I put a picture on Instagram, that's one thing. If I'm doing my banking online, that's another thing.
Sure. Well, I think, context does matter, but I'll give you an example of why I think even when we put something on Instagram or on Facebook, we might still have an expectation of privacy. And I talk about an example of the book of a young man who, put a comment on Facebook. I think he had, seen a product on Amazon, and he had sort of made a joke about that product on his Facebook page. And at the time, Facebook was using this product program called Sponsored Stories. And the idea was that they would turn people's posts into kind of organic ad content. And so the idea was here that this was something that people were sharing willingly. You know, maybe they were talking about an article of clothing they bought. Maybe they were talking about a book that they'd read. And then all of a sudden, their friends started to see that not as kind of content, but as sponsored content, as something that had been translated into an ad. So oftentimes, I think that when we think about privacy, we try and make this distinction between information that we've shared willingly and information that we haven't shared willingly. But if information that we've shared willingly is taken and put into a different context or used for something that we didn't necessarily expect it was going to be used for, we might still feel that our privacy has been violated.
That's really interesting. So to the point that, well, if you want it to be private, don't put it on Facebook. No, you put it on Facebook because you wanted to say to your friends, you know, I bought this new workout gear and it's really working out great for me. But you don't expect Facebook then to turn that around and make it into a commercial.
Absolutely. Right. And this happens all the time. I mean, we might be very willing to share information with our grocery stores about, you know, the types of produce that we like or you know, what are our favorite chips. But we probably don't want that information, or we might not want that information to be shared with, you know, an insurance company that's going to make assumptions about our healthy eating practices, for example.
Right. Or as a journalist, I'm not supposed to endorse any product.
Right.
So there you go. Well, speaking of Facebook, I would love to ask you a little bit more about the company coming under fire for the way that it uses advertising for sharing information more widely. There's a whole Cambridge Analytica scandal and so forth. Can you put that into context for us of your book, Nora? Because this is really important. And when people think about privacy online, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, I think it is what comes to mind right now. And so we've seen, you know, over the past year or so, as you say, Facebook come under increasing scrutiny for its various data handling practices. And in the past couple of days, we've seen Mark Zuckerberg decide, kind of come out with an announcement that Facebook is going to be a more privacy-focused company. And a lot of that is, I think, is in response to some of the backlash that we've received, that the company has received over the past year. And, you know, to kind of put this into context, Facebook has, since its inception, kind of faced some of these concerns from users of the site and regulators about the ways that it is kind of managing user information. And in about 2010, Mark Zuckerberg talked about the idea in defense of the company's real name policy. So this is the idea that you have to use your real name when you are making a profile on Facebook. And he said, you know, it's really important that we do this because having two identities online, so having, you know, a different identity for your friends and your family and your employers, that's an example of a lack of integrity. And about 3 or 4 years later, after the company had made an attempt to buy Snapchat, which is the app that allows content to sort of disappear after a certain period of time, Mark Zuckerberg seemed to kind of back off that idea a little bit. And he talked about the idea that this notion of sort of transparency, maybe the pendulum had swung a little bit too far on that. Maybe we didn't always need to be kind of engaging under our real name. So it seemed that the company was maybe kind of shifting the way that it was thinking about privacy. But of course, since then, you know, we know that the underlying kind of data handling practices and sharing practices didn't really seem to change all that much. And so I think when we think about this most recent pivot that Facebook has made towards, again, kind of becoming a little bit more privacy conscious, it'll be interesting to see how that actually plays out in terms of some of the products and services that the company rolls out.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you a little bit more about that, because Facebook is so widespread globally, and it has kind of been one of the companies on the forefront of this issue, if not the company on the forefront. Let's hear a little bit, Nora, from Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. This is during testimony before Congress shortly after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, March 2018. And here he's responding to a question about whether people would have to pay to keep their information from being shared with advertisers when they use Facebook. Let's hear.
People have a control over how their information is used in ads in the product today. So if you want to have an experience where your ads aren't targeted using all the information that we have available, you can turn off third-party information. What we've found is that even though some people don't like ads, people really don't like ads that aren't relevant. And while there is some discomfort, for sure, with using information in making ads more relevant, the overwhelming feedback that we get from our community is that people would rather have us show relevant content there than not.
Okay, so there you go. That's Facebook CEO testifying before Congress last year. As somebody who has been steeped in this issue of online identity, privacy, and so forth, Nora, how do you interpret what we just heard from Mark Zuckerberg there?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there to interpret. But I think where I want to start is with one of the ideas that he started with, which is this notion that people have control, right? And I think when we hear definitions of privacy, or even when we think about privacy for ourselves, often we are thinking about this idea of control, right? I want control over what other people can know about me. I want control over my digital information. And I think one of the things that we're seeing increasingly is that notion of individual control is not a very useful way to think about privacy. So if we think about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the way that kind of developed was that some Facebook users did a survey online, engaged with a third-party app, and that app kind of collected their information. But it was also able to collect the information of friends of those people.
So that was the problem. Again, just to remind listeners,
You
know, because some people might think, well, you filled out the survey, you know, that's your fault. But the fact is, let's say I filled out the survey, Nora, and, you know, you and I were Facebook friends. Cambridge Analytica also got a hold of your data, not just mine, which I willingly shared.
Right, exactly. And so when we think about this idea of personal control, those are some of the instances when it starts to fall apart. And I think another area where we've seen this quite clearly is in at-home genetic testing, including some really great reporting done right here at NHPR on the ways in which when one person kind of shares or uploads their DNA test results to a website, that can implicate siblings, parents, cousins, and even family members we might not know that we have.
That's interesting. So if I uploaded my 23andMe results, which I have not done, by the way, fine, that's what I choose to do. But you're saying someone else can take that data and use it to, as you said, implicate others in my extended family who may not want to share.
Right, exactly. And so while companies like Facebook, and Facebook's certainly not the only one, have kind of really focused on this notion of control, this idea that it is always your choice what to share, how to set your privacy settings, who to share your information with, I think increasingly we're starting to see that, in fact, it's not always within our control how visible we are or how much information is shared about us online.
Well, and in that clip we just played, Mark Zuckerberg also talks about the ads. And I know that you and I are talking about things that go far beyond just the ads. Still, when you sign up to use Facebook or any social media platform, it is free. So in a way, you're kind of saying, all right, give me ads. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg can't offer Facebook for free. He needs to make money.
Right. And I think one of the things that's been so interesting about that part of the argument is that we have been taught over the past, I mean, I would say 20 years, that is the exchange. That is the willing exchange that we enter into
right. When
we engage in the digital economy. This idea that nothing is free. And so what we are doing when we go online is entering into this kind of willing idea. We give up access to our information in exchange for content, deals, and services.
All right. Lots more to pick up on after a short break, and we'll start taking your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More on the identity trade, selling privacy and reputation online with Nora Draper in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Civics 101 has done hundreds of shows about how the government works.
But we realized that we missed a step.
something bigger.
All right, step right up, gentlemen. Don't miss your chance to commit treason.
Our nation, our government, is all built on paper and ink.
That's why we made a 6-part series on the founding documents, the pieces of paper that make us us, or rather, we. Subscribe or listen online at civics101podcast.org. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a new book called The Identity Trade. It's about public anxiety over privacy online and the companies that promise to protect our information. Let's hear from you. What are your biggest concerns about digital privacy, and how do you try to resolve them? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. The author is Nora Draper. She's an assistant professor of communication at UNH. And Nora, before we get into these companies that, again, promise to protect our information, promise to give us privacy, and as you write, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Give us a little more from what we were talking about just before the break, the idea that we enter into these contracts, so to speak, with social media providers, with providers of online services, understanding that we will give up a little bit, maybe a lot, of our privacy.
Well, I think, you know, that idea of understanding that that's what's going to happen, that we're going to be giving up a little bit of our privacy, is a tricky one because oftentimes, as I kind of alluded to before, it's not that kind of first step of giving up access to our information that's the problem. It's the ways in which those information go on to kind of have a life of their own, you know, beyond the kind of initial exchange of personal information. And so what I think we've been kind of conditioned to understand over the past several years is that our personal information are a commodity, that they have value, that they have meaning, and that they are something that companies and others might be interested in. And so I think this even the idea, even thinking about this idea of I give up my personal information in exchange for receiving something encourages us to think about digital data as a commodity, as something that has value.
Well, and let's talk about that. You know, we all have our own values around privacy, but I was signing up for a new app recently that I thought would be useful. I don't want to say which one. And I thought, this is great. This is going to be really helpful. But then it wanted access to not just my information, but it wanted access to all the contacts on my phone. And I thought, I haven't asked those people if that's okay. So no. So now I'm kind of bummed because I didn't sign up for it and I would like to. But it isn't just about me anymore. It's about everybody that I am involved with. On my phone or online.
Right. And that's the idea of when we think about privacy as kind of an individual concept or something that we can kind of individually control, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Privacy is social. And increasingly in the digital world, privacy is networked, which is what we see exactly through that idea of you know, I give up information, you know, through engagement with a third-party app or with an app. And then all of a sudden, those kind of tentacles start to crawl out, and that that app or that third-party app starts to get a little bit more information about those with whom I'm connected, who, as you say, have not kind of consented.
Exactly, right.
And I'll even say, you know, I think even this notion of consent, I think, is a really tricky one when we think about kind of privacy online, because although, you know, this notion of sort of notice and consent is at the heart of a lot of the interactions that we have online, you know, you agree to a set of terms and conditions, you agree to a privacy policy, you know, you clicked accept or okay, you know, oftentimes, and I would say almost all the time, people are not really engaging truly with those contracts.
And again, it's one thing to click for yourself, but not for the, you know, 50 or 100 people that you have in your contacts, including some who might be underage. I have children, so, you know, I have some of their friends' phone numbers so I can, you know, track people down if I need to. And they're underage. I don't want to give away their information.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point.
When you talked about the economic value of our data, and this gets into the main theme of the book, is that people see the value in this, kind of like the gold rush or the oil rush of earlier years. And then there are these companies that promise to help us with that. But talk a little bit more, Nora, please, about the idea of our data as a commodity. Now, everybody understands that people use data, companies use data to target advertising. So if you buy goggles online, next thing you know, you're going to see ads for swimsuits and swim fins. Fine. But what further potential is there to monetize our data?
Yeah. So all the way back in the 1990s, when the World Wide Web was sort of in its infancy, there were some entrepreneurs who had this idea that people were going to be concerned about privacy online. People were going to be concerned about, you know, the ways that their information was being collected and used. And while some of these companies wanted to find ways to help people to shield their identities online, to kind of create anonymous or pseudonymous profiles so that they could kind of engage and go into chat rooms and, you know, look up news without necessarily being tracked, there was another set of companies who had this idea that really what people were concerned about was not being visible, but not getting compensated for the ways in which their personal information was going to be used by companies who would be making money off of their clicks and their likes and their, you know, data trails in all these various ways. And so these companies, which were known as infomediaries, developed strategies to kind of help people collect their information and then sell that to companies. And this was really a model of kind of thinking very explicitly about this notion of data as a commodity.
In a way, it's kind of honest, right? We're collecting it. It's valuable. You can get some of the value back from that? Is that what that's about?
That is what it's about. And I think the thing that's kind of important to remember here is that the people or the entities that are assigning value to these data are not the individual. So this wasn't a situation where I would go out and kind of say, this is how much my personal information is worth. It was a situation where, the information might be worth however much a company was willing to pay to get in touch with a particular individual or a particular type of individual.
So the early companies, you know, again, talking mid to late 90s, who promised to protect our identities online better, they, it seems from reading your book, Nora, were more interested in helping us stay anonymous. So how did they do that? And did it work?
So some of them were. Some of them were interested in helping us stay anonymous. And they did that through sophisticated encryption technologies and sort of rerouting messages and communications through a bunch of different servers to make them very difficult to track. And my understanding was that the technology was pretty sophisticated and, was successful in kind of technical ways, but wasn't necessarily commercially successful. And there are several sort of different reasons. I think the maybe most obvious reason is this idea that people aren't willing to pay for privacy. But in fact, we pay for privacy in all kinds of ways, right? You pay for privacy when you put blinds up in your house. You pay for privacy when you get a lock for your gym locker or a, you know, one of those protection screens for your phone so that people can't read over your shoulder. So I think maybe some of the more compelling comments that people who I spoke to for this book, who had been part of this industry in the 1990s, talked about was the dot-com crash that happened in the early part of the 20th century, but also some of the things that happened in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. And this was a time where people were really concerned about privacy online, but not concerned about protecting their own privacy online, but kind of concerned about the ways in which privacy might be used by people for untoward or nefarious purposes. And so what we got, according to those I spoke with, was this idea that maybe we shouldn't be creating as much space or as much opportunity for privacy online. And some of these companies, at least kind of those people who talked to me about this, said that in fact, it was that concern about privacy from that perspective, from the security perspective, that really made it difficult for them to be commercially successful.
Yes, I remember that. It's really interesting. You saw this emerging concern about privacy online in the late 90s, but then after 9/11, some people said, whoa, what's happening behind those privacy curtains, so to speak, online? So as you write in the book, the USA Patriot Act passed. And just remind us really briefly, Nora, what was the sort of the rub of that in terms of privacy?
Right. So in terms of privacy, the U.S. Patriot Act was really kind of interested in being able to collect information about citizens, just to make sure that there was a way for the government to kind of track what people were up to.
And just to make sure that there weren't other terrorist attacks being planned.
That was the idea.
There was a lot of pushback from some members of Congress about this, even though at the time a lot of people were really scared. And this act, as I recall, passed very quickly. But some people said, no, no, we're going too far. I want to play a little clip of Kentucky Republican U.S. Senator Rand Paul. Here he is filibustering the Patriot Act as it was set to expire in 2015. So this is not from shortly after 9/11. But Senator Paul did speak against the Patriot Act in 2015, also in 2011, also in 2013. Let's hear.
This is a debate over your right to be left alone. Justice Brandeis said that the right to be left alone is the most cherished of rights. The right to be left alone is the most prized to civilized men.
Again, that's Kentucky Republican U.S. Senator Rand Paul filibustering the Patriot Act over concerns about privacy. And we're talking about privacy today in The Exchange, specifically online privacy and how companies sell privacy promises. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, as we're hearing. Our guest is Nora Draper. She's a professor, an assistant professor of communication at UNH. Her book is The Identity Trade, Selling Privacy and Reputation Online. And Nora, let's go to our listeners now. And David is calling in from Dublin. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a couple of observations about this, maybe a question. This whole question of data being gathered and shared in two areas lately, I've suddenly realized. And I work in technology, so, you know, I've just kind of suddenly these things come upon me. So one of them is Chrome offering very helpfully to store your password at a given site with some, you know, unintelligible password string. And, you know, how nice of them. But then I suddenly realized, oh, the reason that they're doing that is that if you try to go to that site on your iPhone, on Safari, you can't. You have to go in Chrome because that's where your password is. So that nice service is actually a way for them to, you know, if you have a Gmail address, for instance, then it's another way for them to guarantee that they're going to be able to track you from site to site. And a related observation is cookies. Cookies used to be, you know, on a given site, say L.L. Bean. And, you know, I kind of thought, well, who cares if they, you know, they know that I bought some rain boots or something. But now that I think there are these third-party aggregators that are gathering cookies from multiple sites. So it's now another way to, you know, have your whole trail tracked. So I just, you know, wanted to kind of call those out.
I really appreciate the call, David. What do you think, Nora?
Yeah, well, David is absolutely right that cookies kind of started as a way to help people track information or things that they had put into their shopping carts online. And so cookies, which are the digital files that are kind of dropped in our browsers, you know, they did have this kind of origin as a way to help with e-commerce. But now there are ways in which information about the ways that we engage online are able to be tracked not only across sites, but oftentimes across devices. So if you use a desktop computer to access something, you know, it might show up, an advertisement for that might show up on your tablet or your smartphone. So there, this idea of the cookie as a way to kind of help us with our e-commerce and with our online shopping has evolved tremendously in the past couple of decades.
You know, I'm really interested in what David says about the apps that help you store your passwords. Do you recommend people, Nora, store their passwords online or on paper? Because it seems like if passwords are to keep things unhackable, why on earth would you put them on a device?
Yeah. So this gets a little bit more into information security, which is not quite
right.
My field.
I'm just wondering what you do, though, given all that you know about this.
Right. So I mean, and I think this is one, you know, I won't kind of talk to the password thing explicitly, but I do think that this is one of the areas where we kind of see a little bit of what I call digital resignation. And this is the idea that oftentimes we are trading convenience.
Right.
for what we might think of as a loss of privacy. And so not talking to the sort of password encryption idea, but in a lot of realms, I think we have this idea that we would like to have control over the way our digital information circulates, over the way people see us online, but that might not be possible. And so given the fact that we've kind of accepted or we're resigned to the fact that we don't have control, you know, what are the best ways that we can engage in this ecosystem?
Thank you very much for the call, David. A couple emails I'd like to share with you. Walter says, last year, Facebook asked people on their birthday to ask their friends to donate to a charity of their choice. Unfortunately, Walter says, Facebook kept the donor's credit card info without asking the donor for permission. Walter says, I found this out when I attempted to donate to a second charity and found my credit info filled in. Walter says, clearly Facebook's reason for this service was to get that credit card information and market it. Sean says, your guest has made a critical point. Online privacy is also about how our online information or activity is used in ways we didn't expect. Just as we don't want our taxes spent on things we don't believe in, we don't want our data used for things we wouldn't endorse. Sean says, the end user license agreements in place nearly always have us waive our rights around those unexpected actions. It may be against the end user license agreements to scrape and analyze all of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram data as an outside third party, but little prevents Facebook, Google, or others to do the same thing inside the company. We signed it away. Great emails. Thank you, Walter and Sean. And to Sean's point about, you know, we do sign this stuff away. The agreements are, you know, 10 pages long. No one looks at them. We all just click agree, 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 agree. What do you think about that?
Well, so one of the really interesting things about some of the companies that I talk about in the book, so I talked a little bit earlier about these ideas of the infomediaries, and those were those companies who said, you know, people aren't really concerned about privacy at a sort of moral or ideological level. What they're really concerned about is not being adequately compensated for their data. And in some ways, this model has reemerged in the past several years in something that is kind of called the personal data ecosystem. And this personal data ecosystem are entities, some of them are companies, that try and help us to kind of keep control over our personal information, to find ways to aggregate it, so getting information from discrete sources, maybe our financial information, our social media information, information from a health or fitness tracker, and collect that all in one place. And what some of these companies are trying to do is actually reverse some of those agreements that Sean talked about in his email to create something that they refer to as an owner data agreement. And the idea here is that you as an individual are the person who has ownership over your personal information. And so it can't be used in some of the ways that Sean alludes to. And there's an effort on the part of these companies that are involved in the personal data ecosystem to kind of shift this notion of data ownership so that it really resides with the individual as opposed to all of the sort of discrete entities that might be creating and collecting it.
What's the incentive, Nora, for a Facebook, a Google, whatever, to offer that option?
Well, what these companies would say is that it allows the individual to kind of create a more true or real or complete data set that they can then leverage back to these companies and that they would have a more sort of complete picture.
Wow. Okay. Lots more to talk about after a short break. I want to definitely ask you more about sort of the tension between the companies that find profit from our data and the companies that say that they will help us with that. So more on that after a short break. Keep those emails coming as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Tulsi Gabbard, Hawaii Congresswoman and Democratic presidential candidate. Send your questions for the candidate before the show to exchange@nhpr.org, and then be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, a new book from a UNH professor examines online privacy and the companies that promise to protect it. Our guest is Nora Draper. She's an assistant professor of communication at UNH. The name of the book is The Identity Trade, Selling Privacy and Reputation Online. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What are your biggest concerns about digital privacy? How do you try to address them? Have you given up trying to address them? Are you one of these people that Nora calls digitally resigned? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Nora, let's jump right back into it. And the companies that you really focus on in this book, and those are the companies, again, that promise to help us with this problem of privacy. Early on, you interviewed some of the early entrepreneurs in this field. Talked to a guy named Fred Davis, a self-described internet pioneer, and he says, quote, "I think privacy is the cornerstone of democracy. It's an individual liberty that people should not have taken away from them." That's a quote from him. So it kind of sounds like he has a moral code guiding him. What were the ethics or the guiding ideals for these early companies?
Yeah, so some of these entrepreneurs who were involved in creating some of these companies back in the 1990s really followed this idea of what we might call sort of cyber libertarianism. And this is the idea that there is an opportunity, or there was an opportunity with the kind of advent of cyberspace, to really kind of create a sense of freedom and a sense of liberty in this kind of world that was not necessarily going to be burdened by a lot of the problems that we see in the offline world. So there was this sense that because in a digital world, you know, people's bodies aren't visible, you don't necessarily know who somebody is, that it was going to be a much kind of freer and less sort of restrictive place. And one of the ways that that sort of plays out is around this notion of kind of personal freedom and personal liberty, around the ability to define your own identity, to say exactly who you were without some of the restrictions that you might kind of face in the offline world.
Well, and we heard again from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, a libertarian-leaning Republican, definitely saying, you know, this is about freedom and so forth. So those early adopters or those early entrepreneurs, Nora, were kind of guided by this idea of this should be better than the physical world and we should be able to control it. So what happened to some of those early products and services?
Yeah, so several of those products and services, as I said, didn't really make it through that period that was characterized by the dot-com crash. And then
because tech in general just
because tech in
thought.
General. Right, exactly. And then, as I said, some of the people who I spoke with pointed to not only the tech bust, but also the sort of events around September 11th as being really kind of challenging for privacy-focused companies at the time. And so what we saw in a lot of ways, I think, is this industry reemerging in the kind of later part of the first decade of the 20th century. But at this point, the internet and the World Wide Web looked a lot different than it did in the 1990s. We had the rise of social media companies, social network platforms, and people were sort of thinking about their identity online in some very different ways. They were starting to create profiles and share information about themselves, share images and status updates and all of these types of things. And so when companies started to think about the problems of privacy and the solutions to that in this environment, that looked a little bit different.
Well, and that quote from Fred Davis, the second part, how much, he says, privacy is a liberty that people should not have taken away from them. So this gets to the new iteration of what you're talking about, I think, Nora. How much is privacy being taken away, air quotes, and how much is it being willingly given up?
Well, I think, again, I think when we talk about this idea of privacy being willingly given up, oftentimes the types of behaviors that are pointed to are things like, well, you posted that image or you shared that information or you clicked agree. But oftentimes when we're actually getting to the kind of moment where people feel that they've lost control or that their privacy is gone, it's not because, you know, they shared something. It's because whatever they shared has sort of taken on a life of its own.
And a life of its own decided by somebody else.
Oftentimes.
You know, when we think about privacy, and this is going way, way back, the first concerns about privacy were often 1984, Big Brother, big government is going to, you know, spy on you, breathe down your neck. Certainly in 2014, when the whole Edward Snowden reveal happened, that the NSA had been spying on allies and citizens, that re-raised those fears. But then you see a shift toward people being concerned less about big government and more about so-called big tech. Mm. I want to play a little clip from 2014. This is Steve Croft on 60 Minutes introducing a story on the collection of personal data through data brokers.
Over the past 6 months or so, a huge amount of attention has been paid to government snooping and the bulk collection and storage of vast amounts of raw data, all in the name of national security. What most of you don't know or are just beginning to realize is that a much greater and more immediate threat to your privacy is coming from thousands of companies you've never heard of in the name of commerce. They're called data brokers, and they're collecting, analyzing, and packaging some of our most sensitive personal information and selling it as a commodity to each other, to advertisers, even the government, often without our direct knowledge.
Again, that's Steve Croft on 60 Minutes in 2014. When do you see this shift, Nora, of concern? Sure, you know, as Americans, we're still a little concerned about, or maybe a lot concerned about government spying on us, but the shift from concern over big government to big tech.
Right. So before I kind of address that, I think it's important to kind of think about this distinction between government and technology, because oftentimes I think what we're seeing today is that that's a really kind of tricky distinction to make. In a lot of cases, technology companies are partnering with government or
government. As he mentions in that clip. Yeah.
Exactly, government organizations. And so, you know, we see, for example, facial recognition technology being developed at kind of big tech companies and then being deployed by government and government organizations. And so this sort of distinction that we draw between technology in the private sector and in the public sector, I think, is a problematic and tricky one. But to kind of get back to your question, you know, I think that these concerns about the ways that tech companies are using information, you know, they go back to at least the 1990s. There was concern, for example, when online advertising really kind of started to emerge, about the ways that online advertisers might be partnering with offline databases, companies that had, for example, collected information so that they could send you magazine subscriptions and direct mail, that those might be partnering with online data collection companies to kind of unite an offline data set and an online data set. And indeed, that was happening at the end of the 1990s. And so while I think some of these concerns are a little bit more sort of specified now, as we have more information about who some of these data brokers are, what types of information they might be collecting, and what types of profiles they might be making as a result of those, you know, I think maybe some of these concerns have been heightened, but certainly this is not new.
How well do the consumer privacy service providers, again, that you profile in this book, Nora, do today in addressing modern concerns?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's really important to think about are the ways in which they define these concerns. So one of the companies that, or the collection of companies that I talk about are the online reputation management companies. And these are companies that are looking a little bit less at the sort of data profiles or data reputations and looking a little bit more at our sort of visible reputation. So for example, what somebody might find if they Googled our name. And what these companies have really kind of taught us is that that is a really important marker in the current environment. This idea that if you're looking for a job or looking for a date, that somebody might, you know, Google your name, and what they find out there about you is as important as the sort of resume or CV that you provide. And so these companies have really kind of framed this idea of privacy in terms of the information that's available about you in the first few pages of a Google Google search result. And so the tools and strategies that they create to address that are really geared towards that problem. So how can you kind of control or manage the information that appears about you online?
So it's no longer about trying to remain anonymous. It's about managing what is present online.
That's exactly right. And so we get into this situation, I think, today where we no longer necessarily have this kind of idea of anonymity as the ideal state of privacy, right? We have this idea that to be invisible online is really kind of a problem. You know, if somebody looks for you online and can't find you, they might become suspicious. You know, what does that person have to hide? But at the same time, too much visibility or the wrong kinds of visibility are also a threat. And so we're increasingly being asked to kind of walk this tightrope between, you know, bad visibility and invisibility. And so what these companies are trying to do is tell us that we need to be achieving the right kind of visibility and that they can help us do that.
Well, and it's interesting the language you use, Nora, because it sounds like the companies are sort of trying to shift our desires and our expectations as to what's important. Don't worry anymore, Nora, about, you know, not having XYZ information online. Just worry about how it all looks as a package.
Well,
and maybe you have different ideas.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that what we have been kind of encouraged to think by this whole industry, by all of these companies sort of working together, again, is this notion that our reputation online, whether that's our visible reputation, the information that we get through search, or our kind of data trails, the information that is not necessarily visible to us, but that companies might know about us, that is a really important part of the way that we are able to kind of operate in kind of contemporary digital society. And so it's really up to us, we are told, to take control, to make sure that our data trails are telling a good story about us and that our visible online image is telling a similarly good story about us.
Although for journalists, I mean, we look at everything. So I shudder to think what kind of a profile companies might be creating about me and my fellow journalists, because we look at everything.
Yeah, that's right. And that gets back to this idea of data somehow being objective and somehow revealing
right.
Something kind of true about you. You know, I suspect that your image would probably be very confusing to an algorithm trying
Maybe
to make...
Maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Well, right, exactly. And actually, that notion that you kind of described there of obscurity is a really important one. There are lots of ways that people are trying to kind of push back against this idea of visibility by creating confusion. So, you know, a lot of young people who are often kind of discussed as not being all that concerned about their privacy have really sort of sophisticated strategies for creating these kinds of decoy profiles online. So they might create a very public Instagram page or a very public Facebook profile that an employer or a faculty member would find about them. And then they have these sort of secondary or hidden profiles that their friends know about, that they can kind of communicate, you know, their less publicly ready for consumption ideas or images. And so that idea of obscurity is actually one that I think young people are adopting as a way to combat some of these pressures of having a perfect or consumable online image.
Well, so you just talked about, Nora, how companies, these, again, reputation.com, sort of these privacy management companies, they are telling us, again, don't worry so much about being anonymous or completely private. Worry about how your information is managed. But again, they are also, it seems you're saying, managing how we feel about that. I wonder how you feel about that as a researcher, that not only are they telling us what to worry about, but telling us what not to worry about.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the kind of threads that goes throughout this book is this idea that our conceptions of privacy online have changed. And, you know, this is a very sort of short history in the grand scheme of
right.
things. But if we even think about the ways that our notions of what it means to have these ideal levels of visibility have shifted over the past 20, 25, 30 years, it's been quite dramatic. And it's not just the companies that I talk about in the book. You know, there have been social Social media companies, for example, I think have played a really important role in kind of normalizing sharing as, you know, sharing kind of lots of aspects of our life as a contemporary social practice. And so, you know, the industry and the companies that are a part of this industry, you know, I think do play a really important role in kind of helping us think about what we mean when we say privacy online.
And is that helpful to us? The way that they are sort of managing how we feel about it.
Well, I mean, I think that one of the really important things to think about here is that when we take the idea of privacy and we think about it in the context of commodities, right? So we think about our reputation as something that we might be able to get kind of financial benefit from, or we think about our digital data as something that we might be able to sell to companies to get some sort of, you know, profit from, that what we're doing is kind of putting privacy in the context of the economy. We're taking a sort of take on privacy that encourages us to think in our role as consumers. And, you know, if you think about that clip that you played from Senator Rand Paul, he's really talking about privacy as an ideology and privacy as a really important political concept. And so one of my concerns when we think about privacy and when we think about our identity in these sort of very economic terms is that we might lose sight of the fact that privacy is a very important political concept and that we may want to act in our role not as consumers, but as citizens, to really think about what we want when we talk about privacy.
Right. So don't just define it so narrowly as these companies are. Your privacy as a consumer, you're a human being. You're a spiritual person. You're a citizen. You have friends, relatives. You're bigger than just your data as a consumer.
That's exactly right. And when we start to get into the political questions, I think we start to see the ways in which privacy is, you know, a really important thing for protecting marginalized people in society and people who have less power. When we talk about privacy in the consumer context, sometimes those notions of power tend to disappear a little bit.
Well, Nora, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
It was fabulous. Thank you so much.
That's Nora Draper. She's an assistant professor of communication at UNH. Again, the book is called The Identity Trade, Selling Privacy and Reputation Online. I want to also remind you that tomorrow we'll be talking with Democratic presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard. She's a Hawaii congresswoman. Send us your questions for Congresswoman Gabbard before the show if you'd like. It's exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us for that interview live at 9. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.